Welcome to the Tracking Connections podcast, and thanks for listening.
We feature voices from around the world sharing stories of working intentionally with deep nature connection in ways that transform lives, families, projects, and communities. I'm Sarah.
I'm Aiden.
And I'm John.
And we are your hosts from Living Connection First.
Hey, everybody. This is Aiden. Welcome to episode 20 of Tracking Connections.
And this is Sarah. Today, we're going to talk about the core routine from Coyote's Guide to Connecting with Nature called
Animal Forms. And this is John. And I am really happy to be here and talk about this topic. Yeah, we are exploring something that sometimes is hard to pin down. But animal forms is something that is universal all over the world. And I will first point to the fact that when children are small, and I loved when my children were that age, you know, 3, 4, 5, they would spontaneously imitate animals and become animals on the floor and play with each other, or even when they were by themselves. Nobody told them to do that. They just do it. And in this this imitation thing, you know, it's like a deep instinct. And there's all kinds of research that Carol Grojean was referencing with us earlier that says that when we imitate things, all kinds of parts of our nervous system and brain fire in ways that they wouldn't otherwise. And what I've observed about this idea of animal forms and imitation is that when I'm thinking about what happens to our learning, the speed, the efficiency, and even the depth of learning, if we're just thinking about an animal or even just looking at it, so much of our brain might fire, right? But if we're imitating it, then all these nerves and our whole body are actually activated, and that creates many more connective brain patterns. So you build faster connection through imitation, if you will. And we're not just going to talk about animals. Aiden's got some great stories that will show you that you're probably already doing this or have done it in modern ways as well. So there's a concept, you know, from Dr. Bill Sutherland. He was sharing with me about his time spent in Namibia and Botswana with San Bushman. And he was talking about, you know, these three cultural commitments that everybody has in order to be, let's just say, a beneficial, useful member of the village, right? You're the idea being that we're not dragging on the other people, right? Like, I'm carrying my weight, you know? So it isn't just like for us, maybe it's like, okay, we all live in this house together. We're all going to chip in, keeping the kitchen clean and sweeping and, you know, doing the dishes and so on, right? And you may have had a housemate or a child that wasn't pulling their weight, and you can feel it, right? It's like, oh man, I got to do even more dishes now, right? Because they're just not cleaning up after themselves. The analog in these hunter-gatherer Bushman communities is that these three commitments, if everyone's doing them, then the whole community is lifted, right? There's a sense of lift. And our friend Craig Foster, who was on with us a few episodes ago, when I talked to him about these three core cultural commitments, he said, yes, you know, I observed the same thing in the Bushmen. And if they didn't, you know, if a Bushman wasn't doing those three things, they were considered a drag on the community. So he emphasized that to me. And I thought, okay, that's really interesting. So like when I visited them, you know, over the last about 10 years, I kept going every year, once or twice a year, and spending, you know, a week or more with them for various research visits. You know, I wouldn't have noticed that they were all doing this, you know, and I look forward to going back and visiting now and talking to them about this because I didn't get to talk to them then. But in looking back over videos and going back through my memories, I definitely saw that they were following these three core commitments. So one of them is, number one, when you're out on the land doing whatever you're doing, hunting, gathering, tracking, you know, gathering materials to build a hut or whatever, or firewood, you're not just out there passively with a task. You're also using all your senses as, I would say, the eyes and ears of the village. But then what about your sense of smell and your gut feelings and all that sort of thing? So really, it's more than just your eyes and ears. So let's just say I am dedicated to using my senses on behalf of my village. I might be out getting firewood, but I'm going to look around. I'm going to listen. I'm going to gather it all in. And I owe it to my village to bring it back. So my second commitment is now I'm going to use all of my senses to tell the story back, right? To live the story anew, as Dr. Bill says. And then that third commitment is what they call the dance. And I started to think about, well, in modern times, we can definitely use all the senses for our family, right? I'm going to go out, have an experience on the land. I'm going to bring all the whole story back with all my senses and share it with my children. So I can make those two commitments. But what is this dance thing and why is it important? In a recent conversation with Dr. Bill, I realized that the dance thing is simply the imitation, right? Because I distinctly remember when there was a tree blowing in the wind a funny way, there were several Bushmen with me moving their body in rhythm with that tree, right? Or Sarah and I were observing my son Finch the other day, and he saw the coyote hopping through the tall grass in the meadow, and his body immediately imitated the movement of the coyote hopping in the meadow. And I think that that dance thing, you know, dancing the animal or dancing the story is activating all those brain centers and nervous system responses that I talked about earlier. I think it's a way of causing faster integration and deeper learning, and then therefore deeper connection. And then also because of our mirror neurons and all the activation of all this stuff, the imitation is allowing me to communicate it better with others. So when the Bushmen tell their story, they do the imitations. You know, they don't just use the words. Their whole body gets involved in the storytelling, you know? So I thought, yeah, well, that's what we can simply say, you know? So I'm in a way, I'm basically saying this is what Animal Forms is about, really. You know, when we put it in Coyote's Guide to Connecting with Nature, it was really about that. You know, I didn't have the core commitment idea at the time, but I totally see how it works. So one last thing, and I'm going to pass it to you, Sarah, is like when the Bushmen are out tracking, like we're following a kudu or an eland, their hands are imitating what the tracks are doing on the ground as the tracks are passing under their peripheral vision. You know, they're looking straight ahead. They're scanning the horizon. They got their arm out in front of them. They're using their arm kind of to use as a sight so their eyes don't go to the ground. And they're using their lower peripheral vision, and their hands are marking when a track passes, a left, a right, a left, a right. They use their hand in a gallop. They use their hand in a trot. You know, they actually imitate the gait of the animal as they're walking. And not just one Bushman will do it. Like the lead tracker will do it, but the Bushman on either side of that person will imitate with that person in the front. You know, so there's like this communication through hand imitation. And I thought, okay, well, that's a really interesting way of like putting more dimensions on communication and absorbing from the landscape. So I just think it's a really powerful thing. And unlike in our culture where children are kind of trained out of imitating at a certain age, maybe by the time they're 9 or 10, they're now self-conscious, they don't do it anymore. No one's lifting it up. All ages to the 90-year-olds are all imitating in the way that I describe, and they get better and better at it as they age. So the children are constantly having it modeled to them how cool imitation can be. And these San Bushmen are masters of imitation, not just animals, but imitating humans, imitating each other, and doing it with humor. And it's super comedic. It's really funny. And they love a good imitation story where they get to imitate something funny that happened that day. Then you'll actually have another Bushman stand up and imitate the Bushman who just imitated the imitation, right? So it even gets more nuanced and even funnier. So there's this high value on using our whole body to gather information and use our whole body to convey that information in a connected manner.
Yeah. So when I think about animal forms, I go directly to tracking, where I find it the most kind of practical application. And I guess that would be the evolutionary emergence of animal forms. And when we talk about animal forms, we mean, you know, putting the animal on in our body. So if I see a set of deer tracks and I can't understand what the animal did by looking at, you know, the prints on the ground, you know, say it's a deer that turned around and then started running. In order to understand that, can actually, you know, put my hands and feet in the place in the same pattern as that animal, right? And I can look at how the substrate moved underneath their foot to understand how much they were pushing off and look at the change in direction, right? And I can put the pattern of the tracks into my own body and actually replay what that animal was doing by taking on animal forms. So that's one way that I think about animal forms and just kind of reminding us that tracking wildlife has become almost irrelevant in the modern world. But all of us have that in our ancient nervous system as a pattern recognition and something that we are just wired to do. We did it for survival for many, many hundreds of thousands of years. So going deeper with animal forms for me is then taking on the sensory perception of the animal, where I'm not just looking at their movement and kind of feeling their gait, like how did the deer move across the landscape, or how did the bobcat stalk up on that wood rat? But then getting into the actual feeling of the animal, right? Like imagining the sense of fur on your body and how the pads of their feet touch the ground, you know, the soft pads, and how their claws are retracted, or maybe they're not. Maybe the claws came out and did some scratching. But then moving into the sense of sight, you know, what is the perception of a bobcat and what is the visual perception of a deer, right? With the eyes on the side of the head versus in the front of the head like ours. And then the sense of smell, like what is a coyote smelling, you know, with the, when they're trotting across the landscape, or a fox trotting across the landscape with their nose to the ground, you know, kind of darting back and forth looking for some kind of scent on the air. And hearing, right? If I'm looking at a set of tracks and I'm, so say I'm like at a pond, right? And I'm hearing the blackbirds singing. And so I can put myself in the mind of the heron, right? That's experiencing its feet in the cool water and the stillness of its stance and the sounds that are around it. And there's something for me really magical that happens in that. It's kind of like internal storytelling where something unfolds in me where I feel like I start to understand the animal at a deeper level. And then the movement of the animal, right? Like I talked about following tracks, but then if you put on the animal in the way that I just described, right? Like I put on the fur, I put on the ears, I put on the eyes, I put on the sense of taste, and you know, maybe my mouth's open because I'm panting. And then I start to actually move my body, right? I actually start to move the way that a coyote moves or the way that a bobcat moves. There's so much kind of, I don't even know. It feels like a visceral understanding. It's not an analytical experience. And for some reason, it's incredibly satisfying. But referring back to what John was talking about, I love the naturalness, right? That children automatically imitate animals. And when you're tracking, I also feel like it's very natural to start imitating the animals. And then when you come back to the village to share your story, it's very natural to then put yourself back into the body of the animal as you're telling the story, right? You're imitating, as John was using that word, but you're reliving it, right? If you're telling a story about, you know, how the bobcat bounced down the meadow for some reason, you actually, when you're in tune with yourself and you're reliving that experience, it's kind of like a reflex, right? To put it in your body. So I see this thread between tracking the animal forms and tracking, moving into the animal forms in storytelling. And then like John was talking about, the animal forms in the healing dance with the San Bushmen, and many cultures have dances that dance animals. I know of many. I know Native American, of course, and Aboriginal, of course, have dances about particular animals, right? Like the giraffe for the San Bushmen is a sacred animal, and they have a whole dance that is about the giraffe, right? That tells the story of the giraffe. So I want to pass it back to John and see if he has some reflections on that.
Yeah, I do. They also have dances and songs. Like there's not just the physical dance, there's also the song, and they have dances and songs for plants as well. And of course, you know, we think about martial arts and yoga and hula, you know, these are all forms. And last but not least, there's what most of us probably experienced growing up is theater. You know, whether when we were children, we put on plays for our parents. I mean, I did that annoying thing for my parents, my sister and I and all of my cousins. We all had to put on a play. They didn't ask us to. We came up with it. And then we made them watch. And I'm sure it was kind of humorous and engaging. But, you know, that instinct is there, right? And I can remember, Aidan, when you were young, I didn't tell you to do it. You guys just suddenly had to put on plays for us, you know? And I'm just like, man, this is so interesting that children just naturally come up with it. So, yeah, you know, these are just the thoughts, you know, just again, emphasizing that naturalness, as Sarah just emphasized again, that what happens if we don't let go of that naturalness? And, you know, what can we get out of it? As Sarah was pointing out, putting on the mind of that animal is like putting on a play and playing a role, okay? But in this case, the benefit that comes from it is like an expanded sensory experience. You know, I remember when there were some younger instructors that I was teaching with in Oregon, you know, they were in their 20s, you know, young 20s and late 20s. They were trying to jump up and grab onto and hold the edge of a patio, a porch, you know, that was like an overhead a porch on the second floor. But because it wasn't a bar, they couldn't grab it. And, you know, they'd jump up and their fingers would slip off. And I was watching them. I'm like, what are you guys doing? Well, we haven't been able to stick this. You know, we've been doing pull-ups and this and that, but we can't seem to be able to get to stick it. And I said, well, watch, I'll stick it. And they look at me like, yeah, sure, old guy, you're not going to be able to stick that. You know, you're not in good shape. You don't work out with us and do push-ups and pull-ups. Like, they're always doing that with each other. And I said, all right, let me show you something. So I jump up and stick it. And I hang on there for a second. And I look at them while I'm holding on. And I drop back down to the ground again. They're like, how did you do that? And then they started jumping up again to try to make themselves catch up with me, right? But they couldn't do it. And I said, all right, let's try it again. But this time I want you guys to imagine, and I mean really imagine, that you're actually gray squirrels. Have you ever seen a squirrel run up a tree? Did it ever occur to you that running up a vertical tree 50 feet in a few seconds would be the equivalent of us trying to run up a really steep flight of stairs on all fours and going 20 stories in 3 seconds? You know, it's like they have so much power in their feet. So I want you not to imagine, but to really become the squirrel, because that's all I'm doing. I'm doing squirrel form. And in doing so, it puts some kind of extra strength in my fingers. I can't explain it, but it does. And they looked at me and they're like, that can't be true. And then one guy steps up and does it and sticks it the first try. He's like, whoa, it really does work. You know, so this is kind of like the, I don't know what they are. They're like supercharged nervous and muscular enhancements and, you know, like both sensory and physical, right? Which I think is a perfect segue for you, Aidan.
Yeah, boy, there's so many things coming to mind here, right? I think the first thing I'll just say is my whole upbringing was animal forms like crazy, imitating animals in so many different ways. Squirrel form is very familiar to me. And I think about that when I used to rock climb, it was that same thing. It would be like we would go and we would climb a wall and there would be certain points on the wall where we had to learn to put our intention through our feet in a different way than, you know, a normal climb. It wasn't just putting your feet in one place, you know, one step after another. It was like here, you need to imagine your foot going through the wall in a certain way. And what makes me think about, because I experienced this in music, I've experienced it in sports, it's just this idea of our intention and our imagination seems to extend beyond our body in some sort of a mysterious way. And one of my favorite experiences of it was actually when I was very young, 7 to 9 years old, and I used to just pretend that I was David Cone, who was my favorite pitcher. And I would stand out in the field and I would just pitch over and over and over again. But I wasn't just throwing pitches to the pitchback. I was doing entire games in my head. As I knew which hitter I was facing, I knew whether he was lefty or righty. I knew what the count was. I knew what the score was. And I would just play these whole games. And then by the time I took that out to the mound and was facing real hitters, I was using my mind's eye to imagine that the pitch was already going to the exact point that I wanted it to go. And then I would pitch and the motion of pitching and actually going and throwing that pitch and hitting that exact spot, it was like it was already a foregone conclusion because I had imagined it happening ahead of time, right? And that intention. And that's the mind's eye, which I'm sure we'll get into mind's eye as its own thing for a whole episode at some point here. But just that idea. And then the imitation, you know, connected with that mind's eye intention. And, you know, I struck out 13 out of 15 hitters one time doing that. And in music, all advanced musicians talk about this idea of, you know, you go and you imitate your favorite musicians and you just play along with them again and again and again and again until you feel like you've kind of taken their medicine, so to speak, or their style, you know, and you take it on. And they even talk about how when you listen back to your favorite artists, if you know who their influences are, you can hear their influences more clearly in their early music. And then as they go along and they develop their own style, the influence becomes more subtle. But, you know, they're really sort of taking on the spirit or taking on the energy of the musicians that they idolize. And the other element of this that happens is, you know, this idea of sitting at a piano or sitting with your guitar, or your instrument, and then playing the ocean, you know, or playing a frosty morning, or, you know, just imagining a scene or a feeling or you know, or an animal or whatever that is, and just playing that. And you can see it right there in front of you. You know, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, I feel like, is an incredible encapsulation of this. If you want to go and listen to, you know, a piece of music where the composer was truly imagining those seasons, and you can feel spring as being so different than the winter in their feeling. And I remember there's a quote, I'm not going to try to get it exact right now because I don't remember who it's by, but the quote essentially says, lyrics are for amateurs because real musicians don't need lyrics for you to understand what their song is about. You know, and that idea of just really embodying and bringing through the spirit of the music in that way, you know, and I could go on and on with lots of different stories here, but I, you know, for me, that point is like this idea of the imitation. And as a little sidebar, you know, my wife and I were with our friends and their kids who are 6 and 4 were playing in the playground. And I heard the older sister say to the younger, she said, "Let's be bears." And she didn't say, "Let's pretend we're bears," or "Let's play a game where we're bears." She said, "Let's be bears." And then a second later they were, I mean, their whole bodies changed, their whole, and they were just bears. And then their little 2-year-old younger brother, they just grabbed him and he was part of the game now. And he was their bear cub, you know, but instantly they had shifted into that, and you could see their whole being had changed in that way, their body language and all of it. So that imitation that we have, our mirror neurons are so, so powerful. And then when you take that and you bring that into so many different fields, that idea of imitation, just, I think it really is almost like a superpower because it takes us beyond what we know we're capable of and takes us into a different part of our brain. And I think the last thing that I will bring up about this is this idea that you are also, when you're imitating, you are almost by definition imitating something that knows how to do something you don't know how to do. And by imitating that, you are stretching yourself beyond the limits of what you already understand. And I think that that's a really, really important part of this process too, for learning and growth, is that we are allowing ourselves to sort of move into our edge and expand our edge in that way.
Yeah, I've heard it said that mimicking is the basis for empathy, right? So if I'm putting myself in the mind of the animal, if I'm in, you know, at the place where I'm seeing the tracks and I'm taking in the landscape and I'm, you know, putting myself down at the level of their eyesight, right? If I'm down on my hands and knees, and then I'm putting the gait in my own body, right? We start to have this empathic experience of what that animal, you know, may have been experiencing as they moved through.
That brings me to, you know, one of the things when I was learning tracking, and I could say from Tom, but really Tom wasn't teaching me tracking. He was using a form of mentoring where he would have me answer questions that I had. And one of the things he had me do when I was trying to figure out what the fox was doing, for instance, he'd say, "Why don't you get down to the height of the fox and see through the fox's eyes, and I'll bet you you'll be able to find the next track," which was so true. Because here I am standing up looking down and I'm like, I can't figure out where he went from here. But as soon as I got down to his height, I suddenly understood his perspective and I could see this little opening that I couldn't see from where I was standing. And I went in that direction. There was the next track. I'm like, oh man, so cool, right? And there's so much you can gain from taking on the perspective of an animal There's one particular form that is taught at the Tracker School that we've been teaching for a long time through Art of Mentoring and through all these different communities around the world called fox walking, which is a way of walking that makes your feet fall quietly on the ground. It also prevents injuries and keeps your knees and ankles and hips from wearing out too soon. It's a smoother way to walk. It uses less energy and it doesn't create as much of a wave on the landscape. So animals don't run in fear from you as much, right? The lesson of fox walking came to me when I saw a fox walk up a log that was covered with snow, and I was right behind the fox. So the snowflakes were filling the fox tracks as I was watching. So I was trailing the fox and I was really hoping to catch up to it. When I got to this log, it had walked out on this little red maple tree that had fallen almost horizontally to the ground, but because it fell over another log, it was making like a diving board effect that was slightly angling up as it went, but very slightly. This fox walked on that log and didn't knock the snow off the entire time it walked on it. And the log got thinner and thinner and thinner to the point where I'm like, it's impossible that it's not knocking snow off. And when it dropped off onto the ground, which wasn't a big drop, it was just, maybe a foot or so. Okay, so it wasn't like a huge drop. The snow didn't fall off then either. And I accidentally bumped that log ever so lightly and all the snow fell off of it. And I thought, wow, how smooth is that horizontal trajectory of the fox? It had no component of vertical up and down motion. And that's when I learned, oh, fox walking is about gliding horizontally when moving on two legs, right? So that's another great example.
Animal forms can be really simple and spontaneous. When I was out for a run a few weeks ago, I was running on the bluffs above the Pacific Ocean here, and the seabirds were flying on the edge of the bluff, and they were flying really close to me. And suddenly, I was so inspired by how they looked, and I was kind of feeling that energy in my body. And I just started, threw my arms out, right? Like just kind of play soaring and like twirling around. It was kind of ridiculous, but really, really invigorating to allow myself to feel that experience, with that bird, just to put it in my body, because why not, right? So don't take it too seriously and just give it a try. I was actually investigating the squirrel on our back porch who was eating some bird seeds off the ground. And I got really fascinated in how his feet were on the ground and how his, what we would call, what would be a homologous to our heel, how it was angled kind of parallel and how his knees were bent. And I had to put it in me to be like, how is he even doing that and making it comfortable? And it actually was comfortable when I got into the right position, but even mimicking your house cat, stretching and lazing around, it's just really, really natural and really fun.
Right on. Well, thank you for listening, everybody, and going on this journey through some imitation and animal forms with us. And we will see you next time.
Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Tracking Connections. You can find everything related to the podcast and our current offerings at trackingconnections.net. We'll see you next time.